Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks by the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Brendan Gill. Brendan Gill was an American critic best known for his writing in The New Yorker, where he critiqued film, drama, and architecture. He landed a job at The New Yorker straight out of college and served as a staff film critic from 1960 to 1967, the theater critic from 1968 to 1987, and the columnist of Skyline, an architectural forum, from 1987 to 1997. His essays have also appeared anonymously in the magazine's Talk of the Town column. In total, Gill is credited with writing more than 1,200 pieces for the magazine. He was known for being an outspoken advocate of the importance of architecture to New York City, including historical preservation, architectural excellence, and quality of city life. A New York Life, Gill's 1990 nonfiction publication, contains the sketches of many of his friends and acquaintances over the years, including Dorothy Parker, Eleanor Roosevelt, Alec Waugh, and Man Ray. His other nonfiction works include A Fair Land to Build In, The Architecture of the Empire State, and The Dream Come True, Great Houses of Los Angeles. Gill also wrote biographies of Cole Porter, Frank Lloyd Wright, and Charles Lindbergh, as well as poems, novels, and plays. A year before his death, Gill published Late Bloomers, which comprised portrayals of individuals who achieved success at middle age, including Harry Truman, Charles Darwin, and Edith Wharton. Brendan Gill died of natural causes in 1997 at the age of 83. Now, from the 1990-91 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Brendan Gill speaking in front of a live audience, the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you. I'm grateful to see so many of you here this evening in this snowstorm. When I go back east, I'm going to pretend that what we have here this evening in Portland was one of the heaviest blizzards ever known on the West Coast. And I'll say, and would you believe it? The auditorium was filled with people who had fought their way on foot through these snowdrifts almost shoulder high. The title of my talk is On the Nature of Cities. The architectural critic and historian Lewis Mumford died a few weeks ago at the age of 94. I fear that for most of us, the 90s are enemy country, imprudent to approach and still more imprudent to attain. And Mumford was no exception. True, we would like our great men to be immortal physically as well as in their works. In thinking of Mumford, Picasso, and Frank Lloyd Wright, to name but three celebrated nonagenarians, we tend to assume that because they exceed the ordinary bounds in intellect and in talent, to say nothing of the ordinary bounds of correct personal behavior, for the figures I speak of were, by conventional standards, highly unconventional, they will also be able to exceed the ordinary bounds of longevity, and we are startled and disappointed when they fail to do so. For several years, it was sadly the case that Mumford was both alive and not alive, which is to say that, in the old-fashioned phrase, he had outlived his wits. Selflessly and heroically, his wife, Sophia, nursed him and protected him, as she had done throughout the almost 70 years of their marriage. A biography of Mumford was published some months before he died, in which we learned far more about his private life than we would be likely to read in the National Enquirer about the private life of a rock star. I am not in the least denigrating the biography, which is an excellent one written by Donald L. Miller, a learned and lively professor at Lafayette College. We know to our sorrow that few learned professors are lively, and few lively professors are learned. So I salute Miller as a paragon of academic amiability and candor. I am much indebted to him for his discoveries about our grand preacher, philosopher, urbanist. Miller's biography is a shocker, especially in his sexual revelations, and what I suspect makes its publication an unprecedented literary event is the fact that it should have appeared in the subject's lifetime, but at a moment when the subject himself happened to be in a state of mental limbo, where he could not measure the effect that the book was bound to produce upon his friends and admirers. Miller had Mumford's permission to quote freely from his writings of whatever sort, including his intimate diaries, and I confess that I have been more or less feverishly remodeling my Lewis Mumford ever since finishing the book, in part because of the information it contains, and in part because of Mumford's coolly distanced attitude toward that information. What a superb ego it takes to assert, in effect, print anything and everything that you may be able to discover about me, because everything about me is of the highest interest. Not a scrap should be lost. In the words of Walt Whitman, speaking of superb egos, Mumford says, "There's all that lot of me and all so luscious." Well, perhaps in actuality, not quite so luscious, or not all so luscious. On the contrary, let us dare to say, selfish. Let us admit that, desperately hard on himself, Mumford was hard, too, upon others, and hardest of all, upon dutiful Sophia. Many years ago, I described Mumford in print as being perhaps the only authentically noble man that I had met in my lifetime. This appraisal was quoted in his obituary in the New York Times, but in my heart I was aware by then that the bold adjective, noble, had lost a good deal of its luster. I am a believer in the maxim, de mortuis nil nisi bonum, but only for a limited period of time, and not out of respect for an individual who has died, but out of respect for the fact of death itself are not altogether undesirable fate. The more important the individual, the more important it is that the truth about him should be known, whether it be good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant. And while I record my astonishment at Mumford's wishing to have so much revealed about his personal life, simultaneously I applaud his courage. All the more so because I am one who conspicuously lacks that virtue. As much dirty linen as I may be said to be in possession of at this late stage in my life, I keep cravenly scrubbing away at in hopes of its regaining the immaculateness of a still unscribbled upon sheet of white paper. The knowledge of Mumford that I acquired through his partial autobiographies and the more recently through the Miller biography, has not made him less a great man to me, only a very different man from that lofty figure in whose shadow I had felt myself to be working when, 2 or 3 years ago, I revived in the New Yorker magazine the department on architecture called The Skyline, which Mumford began to write in 1931. And continued to write for over 30 years. His inspiringness as a teacher, his eloquence as a prophet, are not diminished by the discovery that he was also, alas, a member of the human race. I count myself among the thousands, perhaps indeed among the tens of thousands of people who, over the past half century, have learned more about the nature of cities from Mumford than from any other single source. I say the nature of cities, for plainly it is not enough to live in a city to become an authority on it. The face of a city is not its nature. Neither are its sounds and smells. There is ever so much more to any city than even the most sharp-eyed of its inhabitants is likely to be able to take in and pass accurate judgment upon simply by walking its streets and staring down upon its rooftops from the highest of its towers. And I may say, in connection with Portland, I hope, not too high towers. I am alarmed to see, directly across the street from my room in the Heathman Hotel, what appears to be the highest crane in the world. Of an inept play opening on Broadway, Tallulah Bankhead said once, "There is less here than meets the eye." This is never the case with cities. Indeed, of the smallest of cities, it is safe to say that it contains more than meets the eye in even its most obscure aspects, the source of its electric power, say, or the location of its largely invisible sewage disposal plants. Similarly, the vulgar aphorism, "What you see is what you get," applies readily enough to politics or to horse racing or to TV sitcoms. But when it comes to cities, what we see is only a small portion of what we get, either in physical terms or, more significantly, in non-physical terms, what with Mumford we might risk calling spiritual terms. For the city is a complex mystery existing inside our heads as well as outside them. And we who are students of cities may well spend our lives seeking in vain to elucidate that mystery. To begin with, why are we here in the intricately built up artifice of this city or of any city? Why are we not out roaming green fields and pastures, or fishing in streams, or sailing on the open sea, pagans contentedly, mindlessly taking the sun alone or among a few choice companions? Why do we not say, with the poet Charles Olson, "Here I stand, happy on my hill, in the clear cold of the best of my life"? And let me just mention in passing that I too have my hill, and it is indeed clear and cold there, being one of the many hills in the highest and coldest village in Connecticut. But even in summer, when the cold is welcome, and I am sitting on the deck of a little 100-year-old boathouse, looking out over a blue mountain lake with the sun bright upon the water, and with the breeze blowing through the forest of hemlocks behind me, all I want in the world is to be back in New York on scruffy, dusty 43rd Street, typing away in my bleak monk's cell at the New Yorker. What is the power of the city over me and over millions of New Yorkers not unlike me? What draws us to its heart when common sense tells us that we should be running at top speed in the opposite direction? Dirty, dark, and deadly dangerous. That is my own dearly beloved New York. And it is also Sodom and Gomorrah. It is an ever-increasing mountain of uncollected garbage. It is 3 murders a day, rain or shine. It is crack in every alleyway and on Park Avenue as well. It is rape in Central Park. It is an old lady knocked down by a hit-and-run driver and robbed of her purse as she lies dying. Why on earth should I leave such a city with reluctance? Why do I return to it with delight? To ask that question is to seize at least the tip of the tail of the dragonish mystery called the city. And it is Mumford whom we turn to first for an explanation. Mumford, who devoted much of his life to confronting the dragon, and who yet chose to live as far from any and all cities as he could conveniently get. This was a paradox in the world's eyes, though not in his. To do justice to the horrors of megalopolis required, so he said, a hermit's isolation. He lived in a village in the Berkshires, not, I am quick to say, as pretty or as old, but every bit as remote as the village that I have often been informed that I should be so happy in and that I am always stealing away from on the most implausible of pretexts. In a little farmhouse deep in the countryside, at a desk notable for its neatness, Mumford sat and wrote book after book about the tumultuous disorder of cities. If one were obliged to reduce the sum of these books to their essence, and if that essence were obliged to be expressed by a single phrase, one would say, "The city is civilization." How simple and succinct a formulation. Once we have uttered it, we have nothing left to do, perhaps, but jump up out of our seats and adjourn to the nearest merrymaking pub. Well, not quite, not yet. For now, how hard we must work to make those four words, "The city is civilization," surrender their taint of glibness and yield a meaning worthy of Mumford and worthy no less of those of us who are his followers. As a first step, what if we were to say, "The city is civilization, and everything that is not the city is parasitical upon it." And by parasitical, we would mean that whatever else it might be, it was an invention of a temporarily dominant culture and not a self-sustaining entity. Those fields and streams and that open sea of which I was speaking a few moments ago, forget them. They nourish us only to the degree to which we impose some human meaning upon them, which we then respond to with what we consider appropriate emotions, which are those of city folk in a romantic country setting. As for quoting the Bible, "I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills whence cometh my help," forget that too. For there is literally nothing in those hills except what we bring to them from the inscape of the mind. A learned response, a learned response, a Pavlovian slavering prompted by the civilization into which we happen to have been born. Does this proposition make you uneasy? Let me give you an example of what I am getting at. The Renaissance poet Petrarch is said to have been the first person in history to regard the Alps as a manifestation of the sublime. At any rate, the first person to write about them in such terms. Before him, in the days of the Romans and Carthaginians, think of poor Hannibal and those shushing elephants of his. To say nothing of the hairy, unlettered Visigoths, the Alps were simply an almost insurmountable barrier, an ordeal to be overcome at the risk of one's life. After Petrarch, the Alps became increasingly an aesthetic experience as well as an ordeal. And by the late 18th century, when young English milords were engaged in making the grand tour, they knew perfectly well what was expected of them. No matter how cloddish they might be, at their first glimpse of Mont Blanc, they burst into tears. Man has been described in many ways, as the animal that laughs, as the animal that knows it dies, and as the animal that seeks to civilize itself. And this is to say that man seeks to come together with his own kind, not merely by instinct for the common good. Many of our fellow creatures do this and have been praised for doing it more efficiently than we do. But rather, man seeks to come together with his own kind for a purpose that self-consciously arrived at and subject to change is capable of embracing an unlimited period of time, both past and future. If we can agree upon this definition of what man is, then perhaps we will be able to agree that the chief means by which man has gone about the process of civilizing himself has been by the creation of cities. Astonishingly, the very earliest cities in history appear to have been built for the dead and not for the living. Moreover, it appears that man's intention at that remote point in time was to house the dead better than he housed the living. At first glance, an absurd state of affairs, but not so absurd that it hasn't persisted down through innumerable millennia and well into our own time. In New York, our two great cemeteries, that is, our two great necropolises, our two great cities of the dead, Greenwood and Woodlawn, contain pillared mansions of granite and marble, incomparably more luxurious than the private houses of our living, high and mighty nabobs on the Upper East Side. The pharaohs had their windowless pyramids. New Yorkers are better off. We have our tombs with windows, Tiffany windows at that, and I am in a position to know that at least one of these tombs contains, among other furnishings, a comfortable old cane-bottomed rocking chair, which in fine weather, a friend of mine, opening the door of the family tomb, pulls out into the daylight, and upon which he sits in the sun and peruses the Morning Times. Well, from cities for the dead, man progressed at ever-increasing speed to cities for the living. And these cities evolved in turn over thousands of years from high wall citadels for the protection of the inhabitants to centers of government, commerce, and religion. The walls came tumbling down and the boulevards emerged. In two formidably hefty books, The Culture of Cities and The City in History, Mumford traces the means by which technology has served as the handmaiden of urban culture, making possible the gathering together of greater and greater numbers of people, all of them in need of food, shelter, clothing, air, light, and water. Not that Mumford, recording in what Ada Louise Huxtable has called his hortatory prose, the expanding complexity of cities, consented to the vulgar notion that a succession of changes amounted to progress. On the contrary, he was evangelically eager to demonstrate that the history of our cities is often a record of steps leading down instead of up, of our surrendering some of the leading attributes of civilization in the very act of seeming to acquire them. I have sometimes claimed to be a disciple of Mumford, but in his lifetime he complained that I wasn't always a sufficiently knowledgeable one. Once upon a time, I was invited to give a talk at the Metropolitan Museum in New York on the topic of utopian suburbs. Knowing that Mumford had lived for several years in his youth in an experimental housing project called Sunnyside Gardens, just across the river from Manhattan, I telephoned him in the country, mentioned the name of my talk, and began to inquire about Sunnyside. Instantly, the memorable, deep Mumford voice broke in upon me, charged with irritation. "In the first place, my dear Brendan," he said, "Sunnyside wasn't utopian, and in the second place, it wasn't a suburb." Silence, during which I sensed that there wasn't going to be a third place. Hastily, I bade him farewell. Mumford liked to compare himself to Jonah instead of to Jeremiah. If he preached woe, it was woe with warmth and without wrath. Characteristically, he had a soft spot in his heart for Pompeii, of which he would have liked to be a native, a very big native, twice as brawny as his fellow Pompeians, and wearing, in my imagination, a gorgeous purple toga. For the pleasure it gives me, and I hope for the pleasure it may give you, let me quote a few sentences from one of his speeches. This is Mumford. "Ever since I visited the ancient Italian town of Pompeii, buried under the ashes of Vesuvius in AD 79, I have found myself comparing the dead city that has been brought to life there with the seemingly live cities that we are living in, or more often trying to get away from in America. This comparison continues to haunt me. This little provincial town of some 25,000 inhabitants produced such an orderly and coherent and aesthetically animated life that even in its ruined state, it gives a less ruinous impression than the central areas of most American cities of 10 times that population. When one considers the amount of space and fine building given to Pompeii's temples, its markets, its law courts, its public baths, its stadium, its handsome theater, all conceived and built on the human scale with great nobility of form, one realizes that American towns, far more wealthy and populous than Pompeii, do not, except in very rare cases, have anything like this kind of civic equipment, even in makeshift form. Every part of Pompeii was within walking distance, as if its inhabitants enjoyed each other and wished to profit by each other's company. And the thousands of people who gathered to watch the games or attend the theater could leave their seats and reach home on foot before a similar American crowd could begin to get their cars out of a parking lot. In terms of biological vitality, in terms of social life, there is no question as to which kind of community could offer the best facilities and enjoyments for its inhabitants. Now, mind you, Pompeii was not a showpiece or an ideal community. Far from it. It was just an ordinary Roman provincial town, so well designed that if it were not for Vesuvius, it might still be doing business on the same spot. End of Mumford. You will have noticed certain words in that excerpt which recur again and again throughout Mumford's texts. Words like orderly, coherent, and animated, and especially the phrases nobility of form, biological vitality, and human scale. Here in America in 1990, we do well to listen to Mumford from the far side of the grave as he insists upon our striving to become Pompeian, insists, that is to say, upon our choosing a scale appropriate to our size and to our physical and emotional requirements. The fact is, however, that we appear adamantly, perversely unwilling to do so. We not only ignore that human scale, wantonly we repudiate it. Over the past couple of years, I have visited a number of American cities and have observed, nearly always with dismay, a contempt for those attributes of human life. Coherence, orderliness, nobility of form, that Mumford spent a lifetime eloquently championing as hallmarks not merely of urban architecture, but of civilization itself. More and more, we begin to look like victims of a shared but largely ignored disaster, out of which has begun to emerge a common fear. The disaster is that of an aggressive, seemingly uncontrollable process of overbuilding, with a consequent destruction of the scale upon which our cities have hitherto been constructed. The fear is that in their new, colossal scale, these cities are becoming not merely unrecognizable, but uninhabitable. The sources of the common disaster and common fear are plain enough. The prosperity that has been enjoyed for so many years now by the upper levels of our urban society has led to an ever-increasing demand for office space, hotel space, apartment space, and the like. At the same time, federal, state, and city tax laws have been hand-tailored to make the greatest possible profits available to real estate developers in the shortest possible space of time. As if these inducements were not sufficient, zoning restrictions in many cities have been silently abrogated, allowing buildings to usurp more space upon the ground and in the air than they were ever previously allowed to do. Not that sheer bulk has been the only offensive aspect of our prolonged building boom. the high rentals that landlords currently find it possible to charge per square foot in office buildings has led to the designing of sliver-like towers that in past times would have been discarded in the planning stage as uneconomical. Since so much of the space in any skyscraper must be devoted to utilities, elevators, fire stairs, and lavatories. Indeed, it was widely assumed some 20 or 30 years ago that the vogue for skyscrapers would soon pass because they were inherently unprofitable. I myself wrote an article to that effect in The New Yorker 25 years ago. Oh, God, how wrong I was. That the skyscraper has survived and flourished is thanks to two factors. The unprecedentedly high prices that the current generation of wealthy corporations and wealthy individuals is willing to pay for the real estate and the prestige that irrationally adheres to very tall buildings, whether they are erected on Fifth Avenue or in a city newly carved out of an equatorial jungle. For some thousands of years that we know about, mankind has felt challenged to outwit gravity and build towers that reach toward heaven. That primordial urge is evidently still to be reckoned with and is every bit as puissant as money. In my travels, I have observed that some cities seem far better fitted than others to survive the threat of uninhabitability. This fitness appears to reflect an integrity based not so much upon age, though age helps, as upon a continuity of cultural traditions that have been handed down for at least a few generations. I have heard that this is the case with Portland, and I stand ready to be convinced. The presence of so many of you here this evening is the sort of evidence that any author is happy to possess. As one might expect, boom towns tend to lack this integrity of cultural inheritance, either because they are too young to have achieved it or because they have ruthlessly disposed of it, along with other space-consuming heirlooms of little or no monetary value. One of the most conspicuous of these boom towns has been Dallas. For the past few years, it has been enduring uncharacteristic hard times, which so far have stopped short of outright doom. One observes with astonishment that even in this period of grave fiscal peril, the lingo of Dallasites remains that of the doing of big deals, no matter apparently that the deals are being carried out at a bankrupting rate of 10 cents on the dollar. Though by Texan standards, Dallas can claim to be a comparatively old city, it was founded in the early 1840s. In its haste to become the quintessential 20th century megapolis, it has effectually wiped out its past and wears a look of raw newness as if it were a badge of honor. Basking in the lasciviousness of money, Dallas shows itself off as a city of gorgeous office towers and empty lots. In one block rises the skyscraper, Venetian in the richness of the granite and marble with which it wraps itself against the blazing Texas sun. In the next block, a wasteland of unmown grass and a scattering of withered shrubbery, with here and there a low, crumbling flight of brick or concrete steps. The steps lead to a sidewalk that evidently at one time ended at the front door of somebody's house. Today, all that remains of the house is a filled-in, sandy cellar hole. Until a few years ago, such a plot of land was bought and sold at an ever-increasing price, awaiting the day when an 80 or 90-story skyscraper would stand there. Whatever its future and the future of hundreds of similar plots of land may be, the fact is that downtown Dallas is at the moment radically overbuilt and no less radically underpopulated, a bizarre checkerboard of self-congratulatory architectural monuments alternating with desert islands. Atlanta, too, is a city busily engaged in expunging its past. Unlike Dallas, it is a boom town that has gone on booming. with an ever-increasing velocity, the not very old, old Atlanta has yielded to a new and amorphous mega-Atlanta, with a downtown center for the most part unlived in and therefore inanimate. The natural setting of Atlanta is exceptionally advantageous. Gently rolling hills and a forest cover of immense, centuries-old trees, surely the biggest and handsomest trees left in any major American city. And this setting is being chopped up into endless suburbs, each with its obligatory isolated skyscraper and hugger-mugger huddle of malls and condos. And these suburbs, unlike their predecessors in the 1920s, do not shake themselves down into neighborhoods, acknowledging their dependence for cultural nourishment upon a nearby urban downtown. They exist as islands among 100 other islands, with no more organic relationship to one another than so many hard-edged mobile homes scattered at random over an all too readily defiled landscape. Seeking a relief from the unwelcome success of boom towns, one thinks of Pittsburgh, a model of survival against high odds. Once the butt of innumerable sour jokes about its sooty ugliness and lack of refinement, and once threatened with near extinction through the loss of its mighty place as the great steel manufacturing center of the country, Pittsburgh today has so thoroughly transformed itself in respect both to its appearance and to the sources of its income that in a poll conducted by the Rand McNally Company some years ago, it was voted the most desirable city to live in anywhere in the United States. I like to say of Pittsburgh that if it were located somewhere in the heart of Europe, tourists would be eager to journey hundreds of miles out of their way in order to visit it. The setting is a spectacular one at the point where, between high bluffs, the Monongahela River and the Allegheny River meet to form the Ohio River. Driving in from the airport, one gains a first startling glimpse of the city at the end of a highway tunnel through Mount Washington, a conventionally pretty rural landscape suddenly and unexpectedly gives way to the whole sweep of the city with its multiplicity of bridges and skyscrapers. At the apex of what Pittsburghers have always called their Golden Triangle, an area of 250-odd acres of level bottom land that makes up the city's traditional downtown. A visitor to Pittsburgh senses, if perhaps only subliminally, as he goes about whatever business happens to have brought him there, the compactness and coherence of the city. Mumfordian attributes observable in respect to both space and time. Standing on the grassy ramparts of Fort Pitt at the tip of the Golden Triangle, one can take in almost at a glance the plan of the city, dictated by its topography. Simultaneously, one can read two centuries of its history in the patchwork quilt of structures that have survived poverty and prosperity alike. The funicular railways that climb Mount Washington, Station Square, a cluster of buildings at the foot of the mountain that includes a turn-of-the-century railroad station, now successfully converted into a restaurant, and a goodly number of the 700-odd bridges that crisscross its rivers, stitching together an otherwise unruly urban fabric. What a visitor especially responds to in Pittsburgh is the sense of the city as an organism whose many parts have been made to function as they were designed to do. In contrast to the situation in my New York, where one feels daily and at every turn that the organism has gone out of control and is running amok, and that no ordinary citizen or group of citizens can hope to restore even the most trifling of its parts to working order. In New York, we live in a condition of stress that borders on hysteria. So out of touch have we become with the once commonplace amenities of urban life, including the safety of our persons, that we consent almost without noticing it to a topsy-turvy mode of existence in which law-abiding citizens coop themselves up behind bars as a means of protection against criminals who roam the streets in perfect freedom. The note struck in Pittsburgh is not that of hysteria, but of equilibrium. According to the FBI, the city has one of the lowest crime rates of any major city, a crime rate that is actually lower than that of Little Peoria. If in the past Pittsburgh was a city rarely praised, Buffalo is a city that during the course of my lifetime, I have never heard praised at all. Even in the days of its prosperity, fault was constantly being found with the severity of its climate and the provinciality of its culture. But it has always been a city that I have enjoyed visiting, and the adversity under which it has been laboring of late makes it, in my mind, more interesting than ever. Up to now, Buffalo has failed to achieve an economic comeback equivalent to Pittsburgh's, with the result that its shrinkage continues to be thought a liability, though to outsiders like me, it appears to be an asset. Contemporary Buffalo enjoys what we may call, without irony, the advantages of its failure. An ample supply of housing, big three-story, turn-of-the-century houses are for sale at a fraction of the prices they would bring elsewhere. And a downtown that, manifesting the civic pride of earlier generations, has not been subject to the mindless overbuilding, at once bland and suffocating, of our boom towns. To be sure, these advantages are balanced by a single formidable question. Can Buffalo survive on a scale so much smaller than that upon which it was constructed? I pray that it can and will. With a population of only 400,000 people, instead of, at its highest during the Second World War, of 700,000 people, it has attained the size that I consider to be ideal. In this period of feverish urban bloat, can cities as small as I would like them to be prove themselves capable of surviving and prospering? If it is obvious that the trend throughout the world is to create ever bigger, ever more cumbersome, and therefore ever more unworkable megalopolises, one thinks of Mexico City and Tokyo, each of them already twice as big as New York City and growing fast. What hope is there for the preservation of cities on the humane scale of something under 500,000 people? A number of such cities exist in the United States, including, I am informed, Portland. But in many cases, instead of being content with their lot, they are eager to expand, eager to become Dallas's and Atlanta's, and therefore unwittingly eager to destroy themselves. One such small city is my hometown of Hartford, which a generation ago was threatened with inadvertently committing suicide in the name of urban renewal. Its downtown was ritually disemboweled. Its middle class fled to the bedroom towns beyond the city's boundaries, and the minority groups that remained in residence provided so fragile an economic base that from having been regarded as one of the wealthiest communities in the country, Hartford became one of the poorest. Now the city is in the midst of an office building boom unprecedented in its history. Millions of square feet of offices are under construction, and in respect to height, nothing will do but that Hartford possess skyscrapers taller than those of any city in New England, including Boston. Why? What on earth do the citizens of Hartford suppose that this mindless urban boosterism can do for them, except render their lives more unpleasant by overcrowding their sidewalks and transportation facilities, throwing their streets into shadow, intensifying their traffic jams, and poisoning their air? And all for what? For the sake of what? Of inventing a handful of new millionaires, or of fattening the purses of a handful of old millionaires? Another such small city is Des Moines, which has a population of something over 200,000 people, and which, having been infected like Hartford by a pathological gigantism, has begun to think that it ought to be at least twice as big as it is. Why shouldn't it become every bit as vast and uncomfortable and hard on the nerves as every other go-getting up to the minute American city? It has already imported from the sophisticated Big Brother city of Minneapolis the notion of skywalks, by means of which major downtown buildings can be linked at a level a story or two above the street, making it unnecessary to possess any genuine street life at all. No more gross mingling with one's fellow human beings. No more impulse buying in shops along one's way. Indeed, no more shops. In clinically sterile glass-walled passageways, secure in summer or winter from whatever extremes of heat and cold may be sweeping across the sun-baked or snow-bound plains of Iowa, one strides with the efficiency of automata from appointment to appointment. Idiotically tall skyscrapers are obviously the next item on the menu. As for a dozen or other middle-sized flourishing cities that one could name, I omit Portland not only out of politeness, but out of nearly total ignorance. Some of them may be standing on the brink of the disaster I spoke of earlier, the disaster familiar to us in New York of a seemingly unstoppable process of overbuilding. If so, they should be encouraged to perceive that the process is not actually unstoppable here or anywhere else in the country. It isn't a fixed doom that we city-dwelling Americans face, but rather a choice of alternatives. Among students of city planning, the cynics argue that only a Great Depression can bring the murderous juggernauts of the developers to a stop. Optimists, of whom I am one, count on the fact that when large numbers of people are continuously pushed around by a greedy few, sooner or later they get angry. And when they get sufficiently angry, they do something about it. I see us in New York City as approaching that point now. Feeling as if we were victims ought to be enough to keep us from becoming victims. To furnish ourselves with weapons appropriate to our fighting back, we turn again to Mumford and his dissection of the pathology of our cities. Let him have the next to the last word, as drawn from his musings on the long vanished benignities of Pompeii. Mumford again. The moral I draw from Pompeii, he says, is that we Americans must be spending our money on the wrong things if our towns are so poverty-stricken and civic facilities so confused and so ugly by contrast, in spite of all their boasted wealth and energy. What Pompeii spent on the vital contents of life, we spend on wasteful processing and meretricious packaging and phony publicity. Our trouble then is not merely that we have fallen in love with the machine and have treated it as a god to be flattered with prayers and propitiated by human sacrifices. Our trouble is that equally we have ceased to respect ourselves, just as we have ceased to love our neighbors and want to be near them. We have ceased to cherish our own history and to enlarge our own prospects by promoting character and variety and beauty wherever we find it. End of Mumford. I granted Mumford the next to last word, but let the last word be mine. No, let it be two words. Always I find, awaited with eagerness and no less eagerly assented to. And they are, thank you.
That was Brendan Gill speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 1990. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces The Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. Theme music for The Archive Project is by Emancipator. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of The Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.